Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. At 20 years old, Pete Fromm heard of a job babysitting salmon eggs. 7 winter months alone in a tent in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. Leaping at this chance to be a mountain man with no experience in the wilds, he left the world. 13 years later, he published his beloved memoir of that winter, Indian Creek Chronicles, which is an Into the Wild with a Twist, in which he lives. 25 years later, he was asked to return to the wilderness to babysit more fish eggs, but no longer a footloose 20-year-old, at 45, he was the father of 2 young sons. He left again, alone, straight into the heart of Montana's Barb Marshall Wilderness, walking a 10-mile loop to his fish eggs through deer and elk and the highest density of grizzly bears in the lower 48 states. The new book is The Names of the Stars, A Life in the Wilds. And Pete Fromm is a 5-time winner of the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Award. There's a film been made of one of his books, released in 2013, As Cool as I Am. He's also the author of 4 story collections, has published more than 200 stories in magazines. He's on the faculty of Oregon's Pacific University's Low Residency MFA program. He lives in Missoula, Montana. And he is the winner of this year's Evans Handcart Prize from the USU Mountain West Center for Regional Studies. The winner of the Evans Biography Award this year is Gregory Prince for his book Leonard Arrington and Writing of Mormon History. And the winning authors will be recognized in an award ceremony that's coming up on Friday, September 29th, 1:30 p.m. in the David B. Haight Alumni Center. Gregory Prince will be there for a reception and book signing. Everyone is invited to that reception. We welcome in for the hour today, Pete Fromm. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So I understand, listening to some other interviews, reading some things, you have a French editor, do you?
Right. I've got he's publishing almost all of my books, translating them into French. The American West is very big in France.
And he said something, apparently, according to you, said something interesting. He said he pushed you to do more memoir and to expand this book. And he asked a question. You got a beautiful wife. You got 2 sons. Why are you heading out into wilderness?
Right. Yes, he was frantic for this book for a number of years. It took years to write. And he kept asking to see it, and I kept telling him, nope, it's not ready. And when I finally showed him a draft I thought was close, that's exactly, he said, you. And I thought that was an odd thing to say, since I was the only character in the book. And he said, oh, yes, yes, we see all the things, your little walks, and you're eating your oatmeal, but we know that you have this beautiful wife and these wonderful children, and the French need to know how it is you have become so screwed up that you leave them to go into the wilderness.
So that's, I don't know if that's the general French perception, at least that's his perception, right?
Right. He was pushing me to step out from behind the screen I had built for myself and reveal what it is that, in France, such a thing would be impossible because, as I hear over and over again over there, they have no wilderness. Mm-hmm. So the place is almost inconceivable to them, the sense of scale, and then that someone would choose to go live with out there alone in a place full of bears is romantic to them, but also really beggars their imagination.
So that does bring up the question. You treat this, I'm sure you've thought about this. Why? And you talk about looking back as a boy. You use the phrase "going feral." So why is it for you that you leave your wife and sons and had? I can understand it, and we'll talk about this as a young man. But as a middle-aged man with family, what's this call of the wild?
Well, that's what I tried to figure out for years working on the book. Going back in at 45 as a stay-at-home dad for my 2 sons, I thought, well, the only reason could have been that I was infected with some sort of wilderness virus while I was at Indian Creek. And then I thought, well, why did I go to Indian Creek? Something must have happened before that that made me want to do this. And so the book explores that. And each time I thought I had it, an answer, I would write that and think, yeah, that's it. And then as I continued to write along, I think, well, wait a minute. Even before that, there was something. And what I came to realize is if you try to pick one thread through your life that leads to where you are, you're pretty much left with a big snarl of thread. And you don't really have an answer. You just have a lot more clues.
I guess it's an illustration that all of our lives are made up of these accidents, quote unquote, or threads. You try to make plans, but that's not what happens.
Right, and accident is probably the best word for me. Just some incredibly lucky strokes. When I was 12, my parents had the courage to load 6 children into a station wagon and drive them out west. I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and when we got to the Tetons, I just took a look at those mountains and thought, wow, that's incredible. This has a lot more to offer than looking out at Lake Michigan. But then I went home to Lake Michigan and didn't really think about it again until applying for colleges. I realized I wanted to go west. And that was really my only a chance vacation as a kid led me to the University of Montana in a wildlife biology program, which to me sounded like just playing outside, which I thought would be cool. And then a fluke, a person I met knew someone who took the job to take care of salmon eggs and spend 7 months alone in the winter, but they chickened out at the last second. And this girl told me, I know this job that you might like. So I called the Idaho Fish and Game and told them I'd do it. Hmm. They were so happy to have someone drop in on them at the last second that they said, you're hired.
And this despite the fact that you didn't know how to do some key things, run a chainsaw. Etc.
Yeah, I didn't know how to do any key things. When they picked me up and brought me back into the woods, they discovered then I didn't know how to run a manual transmission, and I was supposed to use their pickup to cut my winter's worth of firewood to heat the wall tent that they left me with. And then they discovered I didn't know how to run a chainsaw. I'd never had seen one. But by that time, all the eggs were planted in the salmon channel, and they needed somebody to chop ice off of them all winter. And I don't think you could do it today. That the liability would be so high. But they just said, well, good luck. see you in the spring.
So they sent this young kid out in a tent, right, in the middle of winter. I guess you're going to stay there over wintertime. Tell me a bit about that. You chronicle this in Indian Creek Chronicles. 7 months in the middle of the wilderness, your job is to tend these salmon eggs. What to keep them from freezing? Is that your main job?
They cut a channel between Indian Creek, diverted water off of Indian Creek, and then returned it to the Selway River. And they filled the channel with river rock, and then like 2.5 million salmon eggs into the rocks, and they had a head gate at the channel that they can control the flow, and water ran across the eggs all winter as the eggs hatched. And at the end of the channel was a waterfall, and over the winter the channel froze over and then got buried in 6 feet of snow. So that insulated it so water would run underneath the snow and keep the eggs alive. And at the end of the channel was a little waterfall, and every night, the winter was so cold, the waterfall would freeze solid. And that would stop the water in the channel, which would then freeze because it wasn't moving anymore. So every morning I just woke up and walked over to the channel and chopped the ice off the waterfall so the water would continue to move over the eggs, providing them with oxygen. And so my job was about 5 minutes worth of work a day, which left 23 hours and 55 minutes of free time with nothing much to do.
Did the experience match up with what you thought it was going to be? I understand you were in the thrall of some Mountain Man books, so maybe one reason you took this job.
Yeah, the only reason, really. I had a roommate in college who read Mountain Man stories voraciously, and he had us both moaning about being born too late to be Hugh Glass and get eaten by a grizzly bear, or John Coulter stripped naked and given a head start to run from the Blackfeet. Those stories made the whole thing sound so romantic. Just living on your own, being your own person and wild and free, all that kind of stuff. So when I heard about the job, I thought, well, I'll find out about this. I'll see if that's all romance or if it's really, really the way it is. And so I spent 7 months discovering that it's both. It's incredibly difficult at times, 40 below nights, everything freezing solid, very difficult to you have to chop a hole through the ice in the channel to get a drink. But at the same time, you hike up top and, get out of the tight little valley and into the sun and as far as you can see, and the wilderness, the only footstep that's not an animal is yours. And that's a pretty cool feeling.
Well, there are dangers out there, and we'll get into that, talking about grizzly bears, when we get into talking about the current book, Names of the Stars. There's a photo in the Names of the Stars, which is... it's kind of chilling to me. It's your footstep, your footprint, overlaid by a grizzly footprint.
Yes. At Indian Creek, fortunately, most of that time I was back there, the bears were all in hibernation. But in the second job, in the Bob Marshall, it was May and the bears are just out of hibernation, following the elk calves, the elk around. Waiting for them to calve so they could prey on the calves. And there were no people back into the wilderness then. It was too early in the season. So the bears were just walking the same trails that I did to check on the fish eggs. So frequently I would drop down to the river, check the eggs, come back to the trail, and see that grizzlies had been walking along the trail right behind me. Several times I was warned by bears that I couldn't see because the vegetation was so thick, but I'd get kind of huffed at. They kind of woof at you to say you're too close. So yes, there are dangers. At Indian Creek, there are mountain lions out all winter. But these aren't monstrous creatures that they... Every bear that I encountered either ran from me or let me know it was there. It was time for me to be someplace else.
So I guess dangers, but manageable. Maybe we watch too many movies that, where bears are eating us.
Right.
I mean, it's real danger,
right.
but manageable, it sounds like. At least where
yes,
you were.
Manageable with luck. I mean, there's always the chance, particularly with grizzlies, of surprising them and having them charge in just a defensive reaction. When I came out, I talked to my wife and was telling her some of the sort of close encounters that I'd had, and she wasn't thrilled to hear about it. And I said, well, I think I walked the same trail, the same route every day for 30 days in a row. And I think they just got to know me. They were aware of my presence and they just let me go by. Yeah, either that or it was like the Lazy Susan at a Chinese restaurant where you put all the food and you spin it around and decide to make a selection. Maybe they just one day we're going to say, oh, what the hell, we'll try it.
Yeah, so maybe some luck involved as well.
I think so. Yeah.
You described the beginning of your book. What you take with you? You have bear spray.
Right.
What else do you would you take with you on your 10-mile hike every day?
Well, I was a park ranger in the Tetons for many years, and I ran the Snake River. I was a river ranger, so I just ran the river every day. But it was considered a law enforcement job, so I had to have a handgun for that, and I had a 357 Magnum, and which is pretty much considered way too small as a grizzly deterrent, but it was the only gun I had. So I brought that, carried it on one hip, and my bear spray on the other hip, with no plans of ever using the gun and lots of hopes of never having to use the bear spray. And other than that, I carried my water and my lunch and binoculars and a notepad. No communication. The river, I was on the North Fork of the Sun River, and the canyon is too walled in by mountains and too far away from any sort of cell towers. So I was on my own.
Oh, is bear spray effective? You ever had to use it?
I have never had to use it, but there are many, many stories of it being very effective, more effective, actually, than firearms. The bears use their noses for everything, and to get a blast of this fiery spray really tends to send them in the other direction in a hurry.
You write in the book about, you know, you're making noise, right? You want the bears, in particular, to know you're coming. What would you do? How would you let them know?
Right. That's the number one way to survive in bear country, is not to surprise them. But after a month, or considering you have a month out there, it's very difficult to walk through the wilderness day after day shouting, "Hey bear, here I come," or clapping your hands or anything. So I tried to figure out some way that would be a little more manageable to be doing for 5 or 6 hours a day. So I thought of singing, and the only songs I could remember were the songs that I sang to my boys every night at bedtime. And it was a fairly eclectic mix of the only songs that I could think of at the time. Take Me Out to the Ball Game, a bunch of songs my father had around the house when we were kids, Burl Ives, the Big Rock Candy Mountains, the National Anthem, silly children songs. So it was not impossible to feel foolish. Fortunately, I was completely alone, and I have a singing voice that is possible to scare grizzlies with.
That's quite the picture. singing to the bears, essentially. Yeah.
Right.
Let's take a break. We'll come back, talk more about this these extraordinary adventures that Pete Fromm has had in his life. The book is The Names of the Stars, A Life in the Wilds. And Pete Fromm is winner of the latest Evans Handcart Prize, administered by the USU Mountain West Center for Regional Studies. By the way, the Evans Biography Award this year is Gregory Prince, goes to Gregory Prince for his book Leonard Arrington, The Writing of Mormon History. And the winning authors will be recognized in an awards ceremony. Gregory Prince will be to that ceremony for a reception book signing. And that award ceremony is open to the public on Friday, September 29th, 1:30 p.m. in the David B. Haight Alumni Center on the USU campus. More with Pete Fromm following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour is Pete Fromm. He is the award-winning author previously of the Indian Creek Chronicles, other books as well. The latest book, The Names of the Stars, A Life in the Wilds. It's a memoir, and it's winner of the 2017 Evans Handcart Prize. Handcart Award, I should call it. The Evans Biography Award is awarded to Gregory Prince, Leonard Arrington, and the Writing of Mormon History. Gregory Prince will be at the awards ceremony. It's open to the public on Friday, September 29th at 1:30 p.m. David B. Haight Alumni Center. That's free and open to the public. Pete Fromm, understand it from the Names of the Stars. I wonder if you could tell us about this. It's kind of a seminal event, looking back at least. Your brother and father launched a multi-stage hobby rocket.
Right. We used to go out to an abandoned Air Force base in southeastern Wisconsin, and shoot these rockets up into the air. I was 10 or 12, and the rocket stuff didn't fascinate me much. My father was an engineer. My twin brother is now an engineer, and they couldn't get enough of that kind of stuff. But after the rocket launched, we would have to chase it down, often for a mile or two, as it drifted in the wind from its parachute. And that was what really caught me up. My father would figure out which direction the rocket was drifting and point, and my two brothers and I would tear through this scrambled wasteland of sumac and willow and weeds and spring runoff ponds. So we would splash through this mess just running like crazy. Once we reached the edge of a pond that looked more like a lake, and we looked back to my father, you know, what do we do now? And he hesitated and then just waved us forward through the middle of the pond. And it was just such a shattering of all the rules that I'd ever been taught. You don't run through ponds in your clothes. You're never able to be away from all rules. Just charge forward. And we called that part of the game swamp crawling. And to me, it was the major point of firing a rocket, this being cut loose to run wild. And that was, I thought of that as walking through these giant rain-swept open flats in the Bob Marshall, and thought maybe that chasing those rockets was what got me started this way. And when I was working on the book and thought of that, I thought, yes, I've got it. This is really the starting point of what's happened to the rest of my life. And then as I worked farther, I thought, well, there might have been something before even that. It kept working that way.
You apparently, you liked being out by yourself. Even family outings, they'd sort of just, I guess, be resigned to the fact that we're going to send Pete out. We'll find him later.
Yeah, exactly. I think I may have been such a pleasant companion on these trips that they were quite happy to let me loose on my own. But I don't know the reason. I was never drawn to group activities. My parents loved to take guided nature hikes with the rangers. And to me, I just felt like, you know, one of the sheep being led around. And I think it made me feel like an amateur or like a tourist. And I didn't, even as a kid, I didn't like that feeling. I wanted to go on my own. And on a trip to Rocky Mountain National Park, I was probably so miserable to be around when I asked, could I just stay here and try to fish in this creek by myself while you guys go on your all-day trip? My parents just stopped the car and let me go. And that was something that got repeated more and more often as we went out.
I wonder, and you've explored where this impulse comes in your life, you know, going feral, wanting to get out into the wild, that's a sort of taste for the wild. And I think in the West here anyway, we even if we don't do that, we sort of understand it. We because we have it all around us. We talked about France and then the fact they don't have as wild places. Do you think that's innate in all of us, or does it have to be activated by, you have to be exposed to it, I guess, for that to be triggered?
I'm sure there are people who just grew up that way. It was innate. But I think for most of us, there probably is a trigger of some sort. My sons started rafting as infants, as about a 3-year-old. My older boy, you know, he wasn't content sitting in a raft. He wanted to row. And he learned very young to do that. There's a section, a small section I could read when I was first offered the job to go back into the woods again when I was a father, and it might show a little bit about how one of my sons was completely caught in the same track that I was.
Yes, that'd be great.
Okay, well, I was just walking my boys home from school, and a fish and game truck pulled around the corner, and a fisheries biologist I knew in it charged across the street at us, and he said, "I think I might have a job for you if you're interested." So I asked him about it, and he said, "We just came from a meeting about trying to introduce grayling into the North Fork of the Sun River in the Bob Marshall, and it just requires somebody to camp out with the fish eggs for a month, and I'll start to read." The boys, shy at the best of times, clustered beside me, not missing a word. "What about these two?" I asked. If I was thinking at all, it was to hope they'd give us a wall tent, set up along some deserted Forest Service road, a little creek, the boys splashing in the beaver ponds, making boats to throw into the rapids, bomb with rocks as they shuttered downstream, a little fishing, bows and arrows, chopping wood, building fires, all this in the first second or less. "They could come?" I asked. "I don't know why they couldn't," the fisheries biologist said. I asked him to find out what he could, let me know the details, and he nodded, raising an eyebrow as if he'd only been kidding about giving me another job in the mountains. He wheeled across the street to his driveway, gone, but Nolan clamped onto my hand, just beginning. "Can we?" "We'll have to find out more," I told him. "But can we?" He didn't even know if they're actually going to do it, I said, or when, or where. "But if they do, can we?" "We'll see. Even if they don't do it, can we still go camping for a month?" "Let's wait and see what he finds out." "But can we camp for a month, no matter what, during school?" They'd been to the Selway, Indian Creek, more than once. For years, I'd had to tell them bedtime stories based on my winter there. The bobcat riding the deer over the cliff, the mountain lion leaping down a canyon. "We'll think about it," I said. He gave me a look. "We'll think about it. Worse than even, we'll see." Aiden picked up a stick, wheeled left, right, testing its sword qualities. But Nolan plugged along beside me. "Can we make moccasins if we go? Like the ones you made at Indian Creek? The ones that go up to the knee?" "We can make those even if we don't go. It'd be better if we made them out there." Out there, wherever that was, already planning with the same meticulous care as his father. "We could make all our clothes out of deer skins," he said. The fall before, we'd spent a staggering amount of time brain canning an antelope hide, ending up with enough soft suede leather for a decent rag. We hadn't tackled deer hide yet, had no ready supply for deer skins, but, you know, details. "We can chip flint for arrow points, kill a bird for the fletching. We'll start all our fires with flint and steel." He went on and on, all afternoon, all evening. Last thing that night, in bed, story read, lights off, I leaned over for the hug and the kiss, and he said, "Can we?" So he had the bug pretty bad.
And so this is a different experience, because in the end, because they didn't let you take your kids
right
out there.
Yes, my wife, she said they're snack size. You can't take them in with the grizzlies.
Yeah.
She was happy enough to let me go for some reason. But the Forest Service in the end said the Forest Service was going to loan a backcountry cabin to the fishing game for me to stay in. And just before we were about to leave, they said, "We're not going to give you the cabin if he's taking young boys." Sons were 6 and 9 years old. And they just said, "No, we won't allow that."
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, I really wanted to go to show it to them. And I considered not going, but my wife said, "No, you can't do that. This is who you are. This is what you've always done. You need to go for yourself, even if the boys can't go," which was a hard thing for me to do, to have to tell my son Nolan that, "Yeah, I'm going, but you can't." And once I was out there, the fishing game thought that they'd put the eggs within a mile of the cabin, but it turned out it was 5 miles. So a 10-mile hike every day would have been tough. Mm. And then the grizzly situation was much more intense than I planned. So both my wife and the Forest Service were correct, which is difficult for me to admit.
Mm.
But I was glad that they had insisted.
So this is a different, different experience, different impulses, different motivations, some similar, I suppose. You now have a wife and kids. You're not a mountain man.
Right.
You got your son's Batman pillow, for example.
Yes, my 6-year-old gave me his Batman pillow. He was a strong believer in the protective powers of superheroes. So that was to keep me safe. And I even as I was horse-packed into the wilderness, I missed them a lot, but I also felt that I had really let them down. At the same time, the first time we got off the horses, put the eggs into the creek, set up the incubators, when I stepped off the horse and just smelled the sun.
Sounds like you
felt so great.
Okay,
so glad to be back.
You're cutting in and out there a little bit.
Sorry.
There we go. That sounds better. That sounds better.
Okay.
Say the last couple sentences. We missed that.
Okay. Even though I felt as if I was letting my sons down, and riding in on the pack train was bittersweet at best, once I got off and into the forest, down to the creek where we were putting in the incubators and the fish eggs, just the smell of the needles in the sun and the smell of the mud by the creek and the sound of the creek running over the rocks, it felt so great to be back out there.
And I guess you probably need both, right? Civilization and wild. You tend to bounce back and forth between the two.
Right. Yes. And I'm not a hermit. I've got nothing against civilization most of the time. But for me, the wilderness is a real recharge place. And showing it to my sons and has been a big part of raising them and watching them start to get the same sense for it that I have.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Pete Fromm. The latest book is The Names of the Stars, A Life in the Wilds. You can join this conversation by email to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. And Steve has done that. Steve says, "When I was in Idaho last month for the solar eclipse, My host took me to visit a salmon hatchery connected to the aptly named Salmon River near the town of Stanley. Does your guest know of it?
Yes.
Are you familiar with that one?
I've actually been there. I've been down to Stanley, actually steelhead fishing, and know that hatchery. It's quite a ways from the Selway and Indian Creek, 100 miles or more, but it's in a gorgeous spot.
And as Steve goes on, I was there at the height of the summer, of course, but I would imagine that somebody overwintering there would enjoy at least a modicum of creature comforts. It has electric power, a paved road in and out, likely passable with a snowmobile, even if it's not plowed, and, of course, the nearby settlement of Stanley. Not at all in the deep wilderness experience your guest lived. Is this a sign of the times, or are different hatcheries just different, he asks.
Yes, they're just different. I wasn't actually at a hatchery. The eggs that they were planted into this channel were taken from salmon at the various dams going upriver on the Columbia. And the channel, they call it a salmon rearing channel, was just cut into this spot in the wilderness. So it was not a hatchery. There's no power within 60 miles of me. The pass was snowed over in November, and there was no traffic in or out. The closest plowed road was 40 miles away, the closest person 60 miles away. So it wasn't an official salmon hatchery setup.
Mm. In the latest book, it's grayling.
Eggs. Right, which are an Arctic species of fish which moved down with the last ice age. And as the ice retreated, pockets of Arctic grayling were left in Montana and Michigan. They went extinct in Michigan in the early part of the 19th or 20th century. And in Montana, there's a population in the Big Hole River, which is threatened as the planet gets warmer. They're kind of hanging on, and the Fish and Game were hoping to establish another population of river grayling. And so if one river got too warm or, you know, some catastrophe happened, they wouldn't lose the entire population.
Let's take another break. When we come back, I want to have you read another passage from the book. Also, talk about your time being a lifeguard at Lake Mead. And we'll also ask you if, you know, any experiences in Utah here. The book is The Names of the Stars, A Life in the Wilds. The author is Pete Fromm. He's author of several previous books, including Indian Creek Chronicles, a previous stint babysitting fish eggs. And he's on the faculty of Oregon's Pacific University's low residency MFA program. He lives in Missoula, Montana, and he is winner of this year's Evans Handcart Award for his memoir. The other prize, given yearly by the USU Mountain West Center for Regional Studies, is the Evans Biography Award, and this year that was awarded to Gregory Prince for his book Leonard Arrington and the Writing of Mormon History. Mr. Prince will be at the award ceremony, which is open to the public Friday, September 29th, 1:30 p.m. in the David B. Haight Alumni Center. More follows this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest today, Pete Fromm, was asked to go into the wilderness to babysit some fish eggs. This happened, I think, in 2004. Previously, several years earlier, as a 20-year-old, he had a job overwintering babysitting salmon eggs. Both these experiences took place in the wilderness. The one we're talking about in the book right now is Montana's Bob Marshall Wilderness. Previous experience, Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. And that experience was chronicled in Indian Creek Chronicles. The latest book is The Names of the Stars, A Life in the Wilds. Pete Fromm, the title, The Names of the Stars, I understand that's taken from a song.
Right. English songwriter Billy Bragg lost his father when he was a young man, and he wrote a song about it called Tank Park Salute. And the line that I took the title from, the verse, is the opening verse of the song. Just kiss me goodnight and say my prayers. Leave the light on at the top of the stairs. Tell me the names of the stars up in the sky. Tree taps on the window pane. That feeling smothers me again. Daddy, is it true that we all have to die? And the book wound up being quite a bit about mortality, really, considerations of what you do and what risks you take. My younger son's baseball coach had a heart attack and died on the field in front of all the kids. We did CPR and got him going again, but he died a week or two later. And he was 6 years old. He was sort of in that phase, trying to, you know, figure out, do we have to die? Do you have to die? So then walking around with grizzly bears, the question came up a little more urgently now and then.
Mm. There's a moving passage in the book where you talk about that. You know, your son saying, do we have to die? Do you have to die, Daddy? And you end up ruminating. We face your mortality, but not your son's. They won't die. I guess you're referring to that. That hopefully you'll go first. That's one element there.
Right. And as a 5-year-old, I didn't think he needed to face the fact that he would die as well. So. And as a father's wishes, as ridiculous as it is, it's easy to say, yes, but not you. You never you. Mm-hmm. At least as far as I'll ever know.
Yeah, yeah. Do you understand at least one of your sons is kind of following in your footsteps? He's out in the wilderness. Do you worry about him?
Not more so than I would. Or than I do when he's outside the wilderness. I think chances of an accident are far greater on the highways or most any other place than they are in the mountains. He wound up being a wilderness ranger in the Selway Bitterroot a few years ago and would be gone for 10-day stints and then be back for 4 days. And I never worried about that. I always look forward to hearing his stories. Yeah. I've often asked, if your son came to you today and said, I want to spend the winter in the wilderness by myself with no communication, would you let him do it? And the answer is an automatic, of course. How could I not? They've heard all the stories. They've read the books. They've been to these places. But a winter without hearing from him for 7 months, it wasn't until I was a parent that I realized what I had done to my parents by calling them nonchalantly and saying, oh, I'm going to spend the winter in the woods, I'll call you in the spring. was not a very nice thing to do.
What did they say?
my father thought, well, if you want to get a job in wildlife biology, maybe this is something you have to do. My mother really didn't agree with that. She thought getting experience as a complete fool probably wouldn't help me get a job. but they realized I was 20 and I was living 1,500 miles away. There wasn't a lot they could do about it.
I wonder if you have, do you have another passage from the book you could read us?
Sure. This is, I was so set on bringing the boys into the woods with me without really considering where I'd be or even knowing where I would be. This is a little reason, an excerpt that might show when I started to realize that it was best that they hadn't come with me. I was walking upstream up on a ridge, high ridge above the river, and heading towards a stretch of trees that I really began to fear. I called it the Hansel and Gretel stretch because it was an old burn and the trees had regrown lodgepole pine so thick. They're 5 or 6 inches apart, and they're 10 or 12 feet tall. And so the trail wound through them for about half a mile, and I couldn't see a thing inside that trail. I couldn't see more than 4 or 5 feet. Couldn't hear anything because the wind would rustle the trees. And it was a place I was worried about bears a lot. And so I'll read a little excerpt. I plod on, getting close to the Hansel and Gretel stretch, the boogeyman bend, where my entire world condenses to the few feet around me. But still out in the open, the hairs on the back of my neck go up, my shoulders jumping in a shiver. It's hard being sure what you hear while walking out in the wild. All the close little noises, the rustle of clothes, the tread of feet against rock and stone, twig and needle, the wind, the water, block out others. But still, I stop dead, turning my head this way and that, straining to hear. And there it is again, no mistake, a roar in the wilderness. I turn toward it, facing the river, the canyon. On the steep hill of the other side, in the low scrub of new growth, the few blackened points of the snags, they're not hard to pick out. Maybe 200 yards away, the drop and climb of the river cut putting them nearly at eye level. A pair of grizzlies, one wrestling with something behind a charred log, the other standing back, moving in, then away. 30 yards above them, a cow elk paces, watching their every move. The bigger bear, the one behind the log, lifts its head, tugging backward, and the hind leg of an elk calf tilts up, then flops back down. Smaller bear, which seems full-sized itself, inches closer while the big bear's head is down, until, without warning, the big grizzly bursts out, hurtling the log, barreling toward the smaller bear, front legs spread wide, hair bristled out, a massive, terrifying rush that steals my breath from across a river. I've heard of men standing still in the face of these charges, waiting for the bear to veer off at the last instant, knowing most are false charges. And I wonder what flows through their veins, or if they simply froze, only later coming up with a theory to explain their failure to move a single muscle. The smaller bear knows what to do, tripping over itself in full-scale retreat. The big bear, really it should be the huge bear and the big bear, doesn't bother giving chase. Instead, another roar drifts across the river to me, and the big bear stomps once, then turns back, climbing across the log it had leapt over before, and lowers its head into whatever's left of the calf. The less huge bear circles back in. And above them, the cow calls to her calf, that plaintive, throaty chirp. Neither bear so much as looks in her direction.
Yeah, amazing. That. The passage that really stands out to me is it's a dramatic passage. You heard of bears charging, and most of them are false charges. Keyword being most.
Yeah, that's the one that does it. Sitting there trying to figure out if this is going to be the one that isn't a false charge.
Yeah, that's quite the experience
later
out there.
Pardon me.
No, go ahead.
Later, I was... almost my last day in, I was walking down to the river, and it was a very windy day, very hard to hear, and it was out in the open, so I wasn't singing, I wasn't trying to make noise, and I was following fresh bear tracks, but I almost always was, so I figured it was a bear from the night, and it was now 10 in the morning, and I turned a corner in the trail, a switchback, and skidded on the gravel, and that made quite a bit of noise. But as I turned the corner, I came face to rump with a black bear, a big black bear, and it heard me at the same time I saw it, and it whirled around and stood up to see me and smell me better. And that we were probably 10 or 12 feet apart, and I had my bear spray with me, and I had no idea I had bear spray with me. I stood completely frozen, jaw hanging open, and the bear hung standing up as it spun around to look at me. It hung there for maybe a second and then just continued its spin move, dropped down and ran as fast as it could away from me, ran straight into the river, jumped into the river, swam across the river, ran up the other side of the bluff, and I had yet to move a muscle. So I
wow.
began to suspect some of those people who had stood still for bear charges really didn't have a lot of thinking going into it.
Right. Just kind of a response. Well, we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time, and we'll have to have you read the book to learn about being a lifeguard at Lake Mead, many other experiences. Fascinating read. Pete Fromm, the book is The Names of the Stars, A Life in the Wilds. It's the winner of this year's Evans Handcart Award. The other award administered by USU's Mountain West Center for Regional Studies, which is part of USU's College of Humanities and Social Sciences, is the Evans Biography Award, this year awarded to Gregory Prince for his book Leonard Arrington and the Writing of Mormon History. There will be an awards ceremony. Gregory Prince will be there for a reception book signing, and that is free and open to the public September 29th, 1:30 p.m., David B. Haight Alumni Center on the USU campus. And Pete Fromm, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure's all mine.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.